Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and everything that I do and that we discuss here can be found at vnnforum.com. Today, we are going to do Chapter 9 of The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, which is Professor Robert S. Griffin's portrait, as he calls it, of William Luther Pierce, who died in the early 2000s and was the head of the National Alliance and put out the single best white nationalist publication slash broadcast in the world with the American Dissident Voices. And he was a PhD physicist from Oregon State, originally from the South, who moved into politics in the 60s, worked with George Lincoln Rockwell. We've already done eight chapters detailing his background, his past, and where his ideas came from, and now we're going to deal with another person that he was involved with, who himself was involved with pretty much everyone on the right, from William F. Buckley on down to the radical right. William F. Buckley, of course, became famous for essentially neoconizing and CIAizing and making conservatism fans of big government insofar as it led to eternal warfare for Israel and eternal money for defense contractors. Whereas before FDR, conservatism had been concerned with traditional American view that we're not supposed to have standing armies, and the government is supposed to be very, very small, and the principle of subsidiarity, only do what its enumerated powers allow it to do in the Constitution. But Revelo Oliver was on the board of John Birch Society. He knew William F. Buckley, and all these groups. He left JBS because it was a front, and William F. Buckley broke with him because, or he broke with Buckley. I'm not sure who initiated, but in any case, if you don't agree with William F. Buckley's Jew-suborned views on race, which did a 180 in the 60s, then you're a crank. You see, Buckley, to preserve his position, must sacrifice the Ayn Randites, the Birchites, and the racists, and the Confederates in order to curry favor with the New York Jews that William Buckley knew were held the power in the U.S., and he wanted to curry favor with them in order to preserve his own position. So he's kind of a typical, the epithet they're using these days, the kids from 4chan, and it's very successful on Twitter, is cuckservative. Cuck is a cuckold, and it's a porn fetish category on the Jewish porn sites, and it typically is showing a this is a little crude, but this is the reality. This is the part that the stuff on the surface reflects. Underneath, showing a white man giving his girlfriend or wife to a black bull, as they typically call it. So when they call conservatives cuckservatives, that's what they're getting at. They sell out their own race. And it's a newer and even better way of putting what I've always called career girls back from San Francisco, that they are willing to sell out any principle to advance their careers, and that comes from William F. Buckley. But even the ones that are often thought of as good guys, like San Francisco, were actually the same thing. Then they're like, when I was fired, no one came forward to support me. But it's like, well, you never stood up for the white cause in public when you were employed in any mainstream capacity. So why do you expect whites to defend you when you get fired? We have to demand people show fidelity to their principles, otherwise they're just simply too weak. The Jews are a good standard. They don't show weakness the way whites do. Whites want to be, if you want to be the man, you got to beat the Jaime man. You know, was it that was that wrestler, what's his name, who just Hulk Hogan came out and said racist stuff. I don't know if that was his statement originally, but if you want to be the man, you got to beat the man. What are the Jews' standards for behavior? They don't rat on their own kind. They're loyal. Until whites achieve that degree, if whites had even remotely that degree of loyalty, Jews wouldn't have any power. So we have a real racial or cultural defect in that regard, in that we don't show loyalty to our own kind. Somehow that must be overcome in order to take power from the Jews. Anyway, let's move on with Chapter 9, Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. Revelo, Chapter 9, Revelo P. Oliver, which you'll notice reads the same forward as back. One of the members of the Board of Advisors of the National Youth Alliance, who was carried over from the Byers years, turned out to have a major impact on Pierce's life. Now, Byers was one of Cardo's men, and he ran the National Youth Alliance, and he was just basically putting out mailings trying to raise money. Wasn't working, so as we heard last chapter, Pierce joined him and said, look, you got to give the people something for their donations, and that was his tabloid attack. And so when Pierce put out a call, he actually raised more money than he spent, which is what you're trying to do. And it's not easy. I've done that myself in a corporate environment, my own corporation, writing a direct mail package and trying to raise money from it. It's not easy. And if you get the wrong approach or the wrong mailing list, you can be out thousands of dollars in the blink of an eye. You mail it out, nothing comes back, and you go, oh, well, there goes your $6,000-$7,000. Yeah. Plus, you got to trust the post office to actually mail it, which is not fun. Anyway, one of the members of the Board of Advisors of the National Youth Alliance, who was carried over from Byers' years, turned out to have a major impact on Pierce's life. It was a classics professor from the University of Illinois with the most interesting name, Revelo P. Oliver. It is not often one encounters someone with a palindromic name, spelled the same forward and backward, although I must say it seems that I am the only one who is struck by the peculiarity of Oliver's name. Everybody I've spoken to on the far right, when I would say something like, isn't his name interesting, the same forward and backward, has replied with a matter of fact, oh yeah, I guess that's right, and moved on to something else. My guess as to why the unusual name isn't more salient to those in the movement is that Oliver's stature in their eyes vastly overshadows something as trivial as a funny name. From what I was able to discern, Oliver is the closest thing to a revered figure on the racialist right this side of, well, Adolf Hitler. Reportedly, one of his colleagues at the university called Oliver a filthy fascist swine, but everyone on this end of the political spectrum I have spoken to about him obviously thinks the world of him. They speak of him with both respect and fondness. The second thing, after the name, that struck me about Oliver is his imposing physical presence. From photos, he appears to have been about 6'5 and to have weighed in the neighborhood of 240 pounds. He dominated all of the group photos that I have seen, particularly in his younger and more vital years. He was very old by this time. In 1969, Oliver made a promotional film for Lou Byers' National Youth Alliance, in which he spoke straight into the camera. His appearance on the film gives a sense of the man, or at least the image he chose to project. He sat at a desk in a book-lined study that looked something out of the 19th century, with its quaint lamps and the old pictures on the wall. At the time he made the film for the National Youth Alliance, Oliver was 61 years old. He died in 1994 at 86. He had the appearance and bearing of an old-time professor. He wore a dark blue suit with a conservative tie and had a white handkerchief neatly folded in his left breast suit coat pocket. His thinning dark hair was watered down and combed severely back, and he had a dark mustache. He wore no glasses. His voice was clear and strong, and his manner assured and serious, although he gave a hint of a sarcastic smile from time to time when referring to the antics of his political enemies. There was a formidable quality about Oliver that came through. He looked to be someone you wouldn't want to have on the wrong side of you. For those readers who know of the satirist writer from the 1930s and 40s, Robert Benchley, Oliver reminds me of a darker, slightly malevolent version of Benchley. People who knew Oliver personally have told me that what I hadn't picked up from his film persona is his gentility, warmth, and kindness. I never got the slightest hint of malevolence from him. What I got from him was he was more like an academic Mencken. He was very wryly funny and extremely learned. He was one of the few who genuinely deserves the title erudite. He knew a lot of languages, which, that's not as impressive to me as it is to many. What's impressive is that he knew how to use one language extremely well. If a history of white nationalism is ever written, Oliver will certainly be prominent in it, but what is significant in this context is the important role he played in Pierce's life. A lunch meeting with Oliver in Washington changed the course of Pierce's life. And again, this guy is coming out here. He's a professor of physics, for Christ's sakes. He didn't, as he had by his own words said, he didn't spend that much time reading the humanities stuff. So he's doing this more or less blind. He's just a really smart guy who can figure out that there's a problem here and knows how to study well enough to figure out what the problem is. But that's still, to really understand life, you need smart people talking to you and explaining things to you. People who are in your own line but have been in there longer than you have, and even if they're not smarter, they at least have more experience, so they can ground you and make you understand what's really going on here, really flesh out what you just know from instinct and from books. And that's what Oliver would have been to Pierce at this point, having seen it all and, you know, worked for the OSS during the war and been to Washington and seeing how the Jews had taken it over. So he's the perfect guy to help Pierce deepen his understanding. A lunch meeting with Oliver in Washington changed the course of Pierce's life. More on that in a bit. How much happenstance has influenced Pierce's life? How would his life have been different if he hadn't been watching television the day he saw Rockwell try to give that speech in San Diego? Or if Rockwell hadn't answered his letter? Or if someone else to whom he had written had? Or if he hadn't seen Byers on television? And now with Oliver, what if Oliver hadn't been on the board of directors of the organization Pierce took over from Byers? Revelo Oliver was one of the founding members of the John Birch Society and wrote a number of pieces for William Buckley's magazine, National Review, in its early years. Oliver and the Birch Society parted company when Oliver's publicly stated racial views made its leadership uncomfortable. And you can read all about this in The Education of a Conservative, which I will eventually make into an audiobook one day because it's simply an invaluable history of this whole time period, say from the 40s to the 60s, when all of this was being settled on the right and the right was being taken over by the neocons, who only came about formally in the late 60s. Oliver was said to have made an observation in a speech he gave to the conservative Daughters of the American Revolution to the effect that the pre-Castro Cuban government under General Batista was probably as good as one could reasonably expect in an island largely populated by mongrels. Oliver's overt anti-Semitism made him similarly persona non grata at the National Review. At one public meeting, Oliver reportedly referred to the thought of vaporizing the Jews, vaporizing in quotes, as a beatific vision. Oliver's writings have been collected and published in a book called, America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative. The book was published in London. It is doubtful that what Oliver has to say in the book would be acceptable to the publishing and distribution industries in this country. In the introduction to the collection, Sam Dixon, an American lawyer and revisionist historian, on the far right, the term revisionist refers to someone who is bucking what they see as the official Jewish liberal party line on World War II in general, and the Holocaust in particular, refers to Oliver as a, quote, leader of the racial nationalist movement, unquote. Dixon makes the point in his introduction that Oliver focuses on racial self-love among whites rather than animosity toward blacks or Jews. Dixon says that Oliver believes that whites would do well to emulate the loyalties that Jews demonstrate toward their own people and traditions. In order to understand racialists such as Oliver and Pierce, one must keep in mind that they look upon the human being as an animal, like any other animal in nature. To them, the human being is a species of animal, with the races being subspecies or breeds. That is to say, they don't see simply one human race. They see one human being or human animal and a number of human races. Oliver writes, quote, liberals are forever chatting about all mankind, a term that does not have a specific meaning, as do parallel terms in biology such as all marsupials or all species of the genus Canis, that would be dogs, but the fanatics give to the term a mystic and special meaning that imposes a transcendental unity on the manifest diversity of the various human species. But again, that comes from, it may be post-Christian, it may even seem to be anti-Christian, but really it comes from Christianity. We are all one in the mystical body of Jesus Christ. Notice he even uses that word, mystic, mystical. Hazy, gauzy abstraction that close inspection using the eyes God gave us will reveal to be a fraud. Liberals, Oliver argues, engage in, quote, frantic and often hysterical efforts to suppress scientific knowledge about genetics and the obviously innate differences between the different human subspecies and between the individuals of a given subspecies. I reached the conclusion, Oliver reported in one of his writings included in America's Decline, quote, that our race, those of Northern European background, including specifically the Americans, was a viable species, and that, therefore, like all viable species of animal life, it had an innate instinct to survive and perpetuate itself. He believed that those of his race do not realize their precarious status on this planet. Quote, Aryans, Indo-European, Nordic, non-Jewish, are a small and endangered minority on this planet, but how many members of our race seem to have even an inkling of that fact? Are Aryans superior to other races of men? Depends on what values you bring to answering the question, said Oliver. We must understand, he argued, that all races naturally regard themselves as superior to all others. We are a race, as are all the others. If we attribute to ourselves a superior intellectual, moral, or other, a superiority, intellectual, moral, or other, in terms of our standards, we are simply indulging in a tautology, that is, something that's circular, defining a thing by itself. We're superior because we value the things in which we're superior. The only objective criterion of superiority among human races, as among all other species, is biological. The strong survive, the weak perish. The superior race of mankind today is the one that will emerge victorious, whether by its technology or its fecundity, from the proximate struggle for life on an overcrowded planet. Oliver contended that the quality of human beings cannot be judged by the intelligence, academic record, or proficiency in a profession alone. He pointed to mattoids, M-A-T-T-O-I-D-S, as he called them, to make his case. These are individuals who are geniuses in some areas and imbeciles in others. Examples of mattoids Oliver listed were Shelley, Einstein, Lenin, Trotsky, and Mao. Oliver attempted to make the connection between race and the quality of collective life. According to him, if you want to understand the nature of a society, you have to look beyond political and economic arrangements and geographic factors. You need to take into account the society's racial makeup and such sensitive matters as who has children with whom, and the races of those who enter and leave the society. Quote, "The decline in a civilization," he contended, "is always accompanied by a change in the racial composition and deterioration in the quality of the population." That's what Hitler said. Societies die by blood poisoning. The better breeding with the worse. Oliver tied race to his conservative politics as he made the case that American Aryan whites are being threatened by the liberal-dominated government. Quote, "The power of government over us," he asserted, "is being used to accelerate our deterioration and hasten our disappearance as a people by every means short of mass massacre. To mention one small example, many states now pick the pocket of their taxpayers to subsidize and promote the breeding of bastards who, with negligible exceptions, are the products of the lowest dregs of our population, the morally irresponsible and the mentally feeble. But despite the attack on us," he argued, "our big brains, leftist intellectuals, assure us that it is unthinkable to be so wicked as to fight to survive." Oliver harangued liberals. Quote, "Liberals rant about human rights, but a moment's thought suffices to show that the only rights are those which the citizens of a stable society, by agreement or by a long usage that has acquired the force of law, bestow on themselves." He contends that American society, quote, "has been so artfully manipulated that our citizens no longer have constitutional rights that are not subject to revocation in the name of social welfare. In effect, there are no citizens here, only masses existing in a state of indiscriminate equality, a state of de facto slavery." Oliver also came down hard on, the unspoken adjective is Jewish, psychology, which he claimed justifies, quote, "the grotesque belief rapidly becoming universal in this country that man is an imbecile creature whom government and the therapy industry must protect from society and even from himself." He quoted a writer as noting, quote, "the psychoanalyst strives to relieve the patient of all responsibility for his difficulties and to shift it to society." I wonder if that was Thomas Szasz he was quoting. Oliver said that the welfare state currently being foisted on our country, quote, "takes away each year some part of our power to make decisions for ourselves over our own lives. It is perfectly obvious that if this process continues for a few more decades, as our master's power to take our money and to bribe and bamboozle the masses may make inevitable, we shall become mere human livestock, managed by a ruthless and inhuman bureaucracy at the orders of an even more inhuman master." That'd be an inhuman Jewish master over an inhuman and ruthless bureaucracy, as in the Soviet Union. The script for the promotional video film Oliver did for the National Youth Alliance, again, this was done before Pierce picked it up, was published that same year in Willis Cardo's American Mercury magazine, yet another of Cardo's many enterprises, with a very few minor changes. The talk/article was essentially Oliver's cut on what was going on in colleges and with college students. The last few sentences in the film talk, or in the American Mercury article, the last paragraph, was a pitch for the NYA. I have concluded that Oliver probably originally put together the material as a paper or an article and then tacked on the material on the NYA for the film and then left the NYA reference in when it was published by the American Mercury. In any case, the film had the distinct appearance of someone reading a magazine article. The language and syntax was of a sort that is written, not spoken, and this gave the film a stilted quality. The director of the film, whoever it was, attempted to inject some production values. For example, Oliver got up from his desk and walked over to the bookcase and struck a pose before going on with his presentation. Also, there were cuts in the film which moved viewers closer and farther away from Oliver and altered the angle of sight. Overall, however, the film was a rather drab affair. Although then again, Oliver did have a kind of grandeur and air of authority. His talk was sprinkled with impressive references to the classics. Oliver's academic specialty, he was a classics professor at the University of Illinois, and I suppose that lent some measure of credibility to Lou Byers' operation. I did wonder while watching the film, however, how much Oliver knew about the actual operations of the organization he was praising. In his presentation, Oliver's anti-Semitism came through. He didn't refer to Jews explicitly, but when he talked about alien slime and scabrous aliens, we get the message. We also get the message that the National Youth Alliance was not seeking to attract what these years we would call a multicultural membership. Oliver tells us that the college students the NYA seeks to attract are the young men and women who have, quote, inherited the quality peculiar to our race that finds expression in our great sagas of Beowulf, King Arthur, Roland, Parsifal, and Siegfried. Block quote here from Oliver. In many a required course, they, the students the NYA seeks to attract, must hear and recite once more, as they have had to do every year since kindergarten, the dreary drivel about democracy, social good, underdeveloped nations, one world, and all the other myths of liberal make-believe, and they see that the purpose is to excite them in the feeling of guilt because they belong to the only race that could attain power over the forces of nature. Guilt because their ancestors' intelligence and courage raised them above the squalor of universal equality. They parrot, as they must, the professor's gabble, but what they feel is not guilt, but anger, and they are sick of equality. Oliver says that he hopes that the National Youth Alliance will, quote, another long block quote, tell the elite of young Americans what they have so long and doubtlessly waited to hear, not the economic advantages of free enterprise to be reaped by helping some corporation sell more Coca-Cola or hair oil or paint remover, or the blessings of the freedom to buy a mortgage in the suburbs or run faster in the rat race and raise children to be taught that paradise is a place where hominoids with full bellies live in perpetual rut, but rather about honor, loyalty, race, and Western man's will to conquer or die. Young men and women should not be summoned to meetings of a ladies' missionary society, but to a struggle against great odds. They need to be warned not that ladylike conservatives must be careful to love everybody, but that treason of the slimy Ganellan can, and I don't even know what that reference is to, treason of the slimy Ganellan, G-A-N-E-L-O-N, can be defeated only if the men of the West are still willing to die in the pass at Roncesvalles. The reference to slimy Ganellan, or maybe it's Ganelon, in the last quote is a reference to the medieval epic La Chanson de Roland. Well, I've heard that, and I think I may have even read it, but I forgot it, in which Ganelon betrays his stepson Roland by arranging an ambush of Charlemagne's army as it returns home from battling the Saracens in Spain. Roland, commander of the rear guard in the army, survives the attack, but then dies of exhaustion. So a slimy Ganelon refers to the connivers and traitors among us, that is to say, the Jews. 4 months after Oliver's death in July of 1994, a memorial symposium was held in his honor at Jumer's Lodge in Urbana, Illinois, the home of the University of Illinois, where Oliver had been a professor for 32 years. The organizer and master of ceremony of the event was Sam Dixon, the same Sam Dixon who wrote the introduction to Oliver's collection of writings, America's Decline. Among the speakers paying tribute to Oliver on that occasion were Kevin Strom and his wife, Kirsten. Kevin Strom had been a very important part of Pierce's life since the Arlington days, Strom's first contact with Pierce coming when he attended one of the Sunday night meetings of the Alliance. Strom was Pierce's number one right-hand man, as it were. After high school, Strom worked as a broadcast engineer before, in Pierce's words, breaking away from the great Satan, by which Pierce means the life of materialism and credit card debt. Strom moved to West Virginia and helped Pierce set up the telephone and alarm systems on the West Virginia property. Most importantly, it was Strom's idea in 1991 to launch a half-hour weekly shortwave radio program to spread the message of the National Alliance. He called the program American Dissident Voices, and it went on the air on WWCR out of Nashville, Tennessee. The program soon expanded to AM stations around the country and is still a major vehicle for the dissemination of the National Socialist philosophy and Pierce's ideas. American Dissident Voices was Strom's operation. He negotiated with stations, produced the tapes of the shows in a studio he set up on the second floor of the Alliance's headquarters building, and mailed the tapes to the radio stations for later broadcast. He also hosted most of the programs. Pierce handled about one a month. Each show was a talk by Strom or Pierce, preceded by a standard pre-recorded introduction and followed by information about the National Alliance. Some of Strom's programs were interviews with Pierce. Neither man trusted spontaneity. Every show, including the interviews, were scripted word for word. Strom published the scripts of the broadcast in a monthly Alliance newsletter called Free Speech, and sold audio tapes of programs as well as tapes of some of Pierce's Sunday night talks back in Arlington through National Vanguard Books catalogs. Strom also compiled articles from the 1970 to 1981 Attack and National Vanguard tabloids into a large paper-bound volume called The Best of Attack, a National Vanguard tabloid, and published and distributed it through the National Vanguard Books, and that's a real good publication. In the book's introduction, Strom describes the articles as a, quote, chronicle of an awakening. He writes that they mark, quote, the awakening of white men and women to their past greatness, to the reality of their race's degradation, and to their responsibility for their future. It is the chronicle of the very beginning of a movement, the success or failure of which will determine the future course of life on this planet. Pierce described Strom as a vegetarian and teetotaler, a non-drinker. Pierce said that the way Kevin and Kirsten met was that a young woman named Kirsten Kaiser had sent some letters to the National Alliance headquarters, and that she sounded interesting, and that he had suggested to Strom that this Kirsten was someone he, Strom, might like to meet. So I guess I was wrong when I mentioned Alicia earlier. It was actually Kirsten Kaiser that Pierce forwarded Strom to. Strom took Pierce up on the suggestion. Things worked out for the two of them as a couple, and he and Kirsten were married, and she moved to West Virginia. I watched a videotape Strom produced of the memorial service for Oliver. Strom was the third speaker, followed by Dr. Charles Weber, the chairman of a group called the Committee for the Reexamination of the Second World War, and Dr. Richard Schwarzbaugh, an anthropologist and author of a book entitled The Mediator. Sam Dixon introduced Kevin Strom. The Kevin Strom standing at the microphone that day was a youngish, clean-cut man who appeared to be in his mid to late 30s. He was of medium height and build and was dressed conservatively in a coat and tie. His straight features and aviator glasses gave him a John Denver-like appearance. Unlike Denver, however, Strom's hair was dark and cut to medium length. It was parted neatly and combed to the side, and the ends fell toward his right eyebrow. He reminded me of the well-scrubbed men I see working behind the counter at the airline ticketing stations. He spoke in a soft-spoken and formal way to the audience that had assembled on that November day in Illinois. Block quote from Strom here. On August 10th, 1994, for the first time in my life, I suddenly found myself living in a universe that did not contain Revelo Pendleton Oliver. My wife and I visited Dr. and Mrs. Oliver in July 1994, about 1 month before his death. At that time, my wife was pregnant with our second child, Edgar Alfred Strom. My firstborn son, Oscar Oliver Strom, was named to honor Revelo Oliver. I hope that our growing family and our family's dedication to the cause for which Revelo Oliver sacrificed so much gave him some small satisfaction. If our race's future lies, as I believe it does, in the stars rather than in the nothingness of extinction, then Revelo Oliver's consciousness was a consciousness of the future, an example of the intellectual and spiritual greatness of which European man is capable. Dr. Oliver shunned sentimental illusions and was often pessimistic about the future of our race, but his existence on this planet is, to me, evidence that our future path is upward to understanding and mastery of the universe, and not downward through a mongrelized squalor to the primordial slime. Dr. Oliver was not afraid, and we of European descent should not be afraid, to use the term Aryan. It should not be applied indiscriminately to every white person, however. In my opinion, its use should be limited to describe those of our race who truly deserve to be called nobles. Those who buy their appearance, their actions, their character, their intellect, and their consciousness of their mission to bring forth a higher type of humankind on this planet deserve to be the progenitors of future generations of our race. By such a standard, Revelo Oliver was an Aryan among Aryans. Before he died, I was able to tell him how much I loved him, how much he had affected my life, how much he had inspired me and thousands like me, and how, as long as I drew breath, the cause for which he lived would continue. A number of speakers later, it was Kirsten Strom's turn to pay tribute to Revelo Oliver. She was the only woman to speak that day. The microphone had been chest high to most of the male speakers, and some had to lean down to speak into it. Kirsten, on the other hand, could barely be seen over the podium, and the microphone was right in front of her face. She was probably in her early 30s, but could have passed for someone in her mid-20s. She had on large, clear plastic glasses and dark lipstick. She wore a dark, round hat of the sort women wore in the 40s, the kind that often had a veil, although hers didn't, and it was pitched toward the back of her head. Her hair was dark and wavy and outlined her round face and soft features. She wore a dark women's suit over a white blouse open at the collar. A loosely tied scarf was around her neck. I remember my mother dressing this way when I was very young. Kirsten Strom spoke in a girlish, unsophisticated, she mentioned having a picture taken with Oliver, gentle and sincere way. "My name is Kirsten," she began. "One of the things my husband Kevin and I used to do on a date, I know it was kind of a strange thing to do on a date, was listen to Dr. Oliver's speeches. The first time I heard him speak, I knew he was extraordinary. When I came to know him personally, he was incredibly gracious to me. He always referred to me as Kevin's bride, even after we had been married several years. I thought that was extremely courteous of him. Dr. Oliver was so kind to Kevin and me. We enjoyed talking to him so much. Everything he said is just seared into my memory, as I am sure it is to anybody who ever spoke to him. You could never forget him, never, ever. The last time I saw him was in July. We wanted to see him for his birthday. We were distressed to find out that he was very sick. As Kevin said in his speech, we were lucky to have been able to tell him how much we loved him and how much he had changed our lives forever. I just had a baby about 2 weeks ago, and I was really afraid I wouldn't be able to come today. After a great deal of thought, I decided to come, and I am very glad that I did, because this is something I will never forget. I'm very glad that we are all here together. I hope we will forever remember Dr. Oliver, and that we will have the same kind of courage to just keep going day in and day out, saying what we know is true. At home, I have this saying on my refrigerator. The truth is not only outraged by falsehood, it is outraged by silence. I am not going to be silent, and certainly my husband is not going to be silent. Kevin is on the radio every week. You can hear him every week. That is all I have to say. I am very honored to be here. Thank you. Goodbye. As it turned out, Kevin isn't on the radio every week, and Kevin and Kirsten are not together anymore. Their marriage failed, and they divorced. Distracted by the trauma of the divorce and wanting to be in Minnesota, his home state, with his three children, Kevin stopped his work with Pierce. Kevin has been granted custody of their three children and, according to Pierce, centers his life around homeschooling them. It is particularly difficult for Kevin, Pierce told me, because one of his children is mildly autistic. Strom no longer does the radio show. Now Pierce handles all the programs. Since 1997, Kevin Strom has been silent. But now he's back today with the reformulated NA, and I believe he's doing national ADVs again. There's been much speculation about what inspired Pierce to write the Turner Diaries. He had never written any fiction before. Some have guessed that the inspiration was a book by Jack London called The Iron Heel. Pierce clarified that in our discussions. He said that Revelo Oliver was the inspiration. Pierce recalls meeting Oliver through his contacts with Lou Byers in 1970 or 1971 and corresponding with Oliver after that. Oliver had written a review of a book by William Gailey Simpson called Which Way, Western Man, for Pierce's tabloid, Attack. So Oliver wrote a review of Which Way, Western Man for Attack. The Simpson book and Pierce's response to it will be discussed in the later chapter. Pierce said that he had significantly cut Oliver's review. Pierce thought it was too long and that Oliver, who Pierce said detested Christianity, had given over an inordinate amount of space in his review to broadsides against Christianity. At that point, which is still true today, although to a lesser extent, Pierce didn't want, quote, a war with the Christians, as he put it to me. That's a quote, a war with the Christians. Oliver hadn't taken well to Pierce's cuts in his review, but they were cordial enough terms for the two of them to have gotten together for lunch in 1974 when Oliver was in Washington. Pierce told Oliver at the lunch meeting that he was finding it hard getting a response out of people to the message he was trying to get across. Oliver asked him whether he had ever thought of writing fiction. Oliver told Pierce that many of the sorts of people who would respond to his ideas, those toward the bottom or on the margins of society with less stake in the existing arrangements and less to lose, simply don't read the kind of nonfiction material he was generating. If they read anything at all, Oliver said, it is fiction, and particularly light, action-filled, recreational fiction. No, I hadn't thought about writing fiction, Pierce told Oliver. It does sound like a good idea, though. But I really wouldn't know where to start doing something like that. I've never done any of it. Oliver told Pierce that when he got back home in Illinois, he would mail him a book, and that the John Society had, Birch Society had published. It was the kind of fiction that he had in mind for Pierce to think about writing. A couple of weeks later, Pierce received a photocopy of the book Oliver had talked about in the mail. It was called The John Franklin Letters, and had been published back in 1959. Pierce told me he didn't read the book carefully, but that he looked through it enough to get an idea of how he could do something like that. The something like that turned out to be The Turner Diaries, a book which has sold over 300,000 copies without the aid of a commercial publisher and bookstore distribution and has become arguably the most infamous book of our time. Pierce still has the photocopy of the book Oliver gave him, and I went through it. The John Franklin Letters is made up of chronologically arranged fictional letters from one John Semmes, S-E-M-M-E-S, Franklin, to his 93-year-old uncle. They span a two-year period from 1972 to 1974. Recall that the book was written in 1959, and thus its events transpire in the future. Pierce told me that the letters format on the John Franklin Letters inspired the idea of a fictional diary, which he decided would be a good format for writing a first novel. With diary entries, Pierce would just have to look at the world through the eyes of one person, Earl Turner. He wouldn't have to put himself in the place of a number of characters, or assume the position of an omniscient observer. No author is listed for the John Franklin Letters. The preface is written by a fictional Harley Ogden, who identifies himself as a professor of American history at the University of Illinois. He informs us that Franklin's letters to his uncle record the ousting of the Burroughs, the bureaucrats, short for bureaucrats, by the Rangers. The ousting of the Burroughs by the Rangers, an underground patriotic military force Franklin helped form. The Rangers, Ogden writes, represented the resistance to the excesses of state control of every facet of American life. They were combating the government paternalism that was destroying this country. As I read along in the book, I became certain I knew who the author of the John Franklin letters was, Revelo Oliver himself. I had read enough of Oliver's writings by that time to recognize his thinking and his writing style. Did Oliver ever tell you who wrote the John Franklin letters? I asked Pierce. I don't know who wrote it, Pierce answered. It doesn't give an author because the premise is that this is a collection of letters. I believe Oliver himself wrote this book, and that for whatever reason he didn't want his identity known, I said. It could be that at the time, in the 1950s, he wasn't excited about the idea of people at the National Review or University of Illinois knowing he was writing this kind of thing. That could be, Pierce responded. All I know is that he didn't tell me that he had written the book. He just said, did you ever see the John Franklin letters? And I said, no, I never had. He said, I'll send you a copy. It might give you an idea of how you can use a fictional medium to get your message out. And he sent me the book. Even though the John Franklin letters was written 50 years ago, it reflects many of the concerns of those in the far right at contemporary times. For one thing, there is the worry about Big Brother, liberal, paternalistic government, particularly at the federal level. In an early letter of this unpaginated volume, Franklin tells his uncle that it all began with Roosevelt and the New Deal back in the 1930s. Quote, by government, the great orator, Roosevelt, did not mean the people of the United States, acting with courage and common sense in their own communities. He meant a parcel of professional experts minding other people's business who were even then descending on Washington, a flock of theorists bent on confiscating the nation's money through taxation. Later on, Franklin gets more specific as she tells his uncle, quote, the experts have planned us into economic serfdom. Now they'll manage us into organized captivity with an orgy of deficit spending, pump-priming controls, and population shifts. Gee, how untrue is that? That's completely true. And then there is the disastrous welfare system. Here's what has happened, writes Franklin. Again, this is someone writing in the 50s. Anyone can get on the relief rolls. All you have to do is convince a bureaucrat, himself living on other people's money, that you are in need. Elsewhere, he tells his uncle, charity to those in need has turned into a vast system of projects in the hands of social engineers. Something for nothing, that is now the battle cry. An anti-black bias shows through, as Franklin writes, quote, one-third of the nation's crime is committed by Negroes, mostly in northern cities, home of enlightenment and integration, you'll notice. The liberals cry, scarlet with rage, well, what do you expect? They live in substandard conditions. And I add, those rapists, killers, and thieves are behaving in a substandard manner. In another letter, Franklin refers to blacks as a tax-supported proletariat. There's worry about what have come to be called hate laws. Quote, as bad as blacks are, you can't criticize them, writes Franklin, quote, because of the Javits hate literature law. Jacob Javits was a Jewish senator from New York at that time, which prevents what is considered to be unfair propaganda against minority groups. Later on, Franklin writes to his uncle about a Mr. White man, who is serving a 10-year administrative penalty for being discourteous to a black. Quote, this had been regarded as a form of genocide, explains Franklin, since it could do psychological harm to an entire minority element. The New York Commission on Intergroup Relations had previously been after this Mr. White, Franklin reports to his uncle, because he was the president of a country club who failed to include a black among its members. Quote, White's remark to the commission that he thought he and his friends had the right to choose their own associates, quote, was most unwise under the circumstances. End quote. The book also foretells fears about what in these years is called the New World Order. Franklin's letters assert that America's sovereignty is being given over to world governments, as he calls them, such as the United Nations. According to Franklin, this is part of a movement toward a, quote, worldwide people's democratic government. He tells his uncle that the United States is now being governed by the United Nations Organization and the People's Democratic Anti-Fascist Government of North America. And there are the gun control worries, writes Franklin. No dictatorship has ever been imposed on a nation of free men who have not been first required to register their privately owned weapons. However, we are not, as were the Hungarians, referring to the 1956 uprising against the Soviet-dominated government in that country, reduced to fighting with our bare hands and Molotov cocktails, explosive devices made out of soda pop bottles and gasoline. Millions of Americans still have a deadly and trusted weapon, which the bureaus tried too late to seize. So you see there's a lot of parallels here between what Pierce would go on to write in the Turner Diaries and the John Franklin letters. In the end, the Rangers win the day. Franklin's last letter, dated July 4th, 1974, and again, the book was written in the 1950s, tells of victory and the reestablishment of the legal government in the United States of America. Franklin tells his uncle, Rangers appeared in Washington just before dawn. Within an hour, we had control of the Metropolitan Police Headquarters, the broadcasting stations, and the Bureau guard posts throughout the city. Shortly after sunrise, two battalions of Ranger paratroopers jumped from an old military and commercial aircraft, about which you know. A command post was set up in Rock Creek Park. We had almost no trouble with the UN and Bureau guards around the city. They are, as we found out early in the game, more on the order of custodians and doorkeepers than fighting infantry. The professional military forces which had plagued us for a while, Soviet, Chinese, and Indian troops, had been withdrawn for some months to deal with unrest on their home grounds. The book ends on an ominous note as Franklin refers to retribution. Certain high-minded liberals will be among the first to be executed, and they will go to their deaths not understanding why. Guided by the example of the John Franklin letters, Pierce began writing what came to be called the Turner Diaries as installments for his tabloid attack. Pierce said the early installments received an enthusiastic response from readers, so he kept them going. As with the John Franklin letters, the basic situation is a revolt against those in control of America in a future time. Instead of the Rangers, in Pierce's book, it is the organization. Within the organization, there was an elite group to which the protagonist Earl Turner belongs called the Order. In Nazi Germany, the cadre of the best young National Socialist Party members was called the Order. When I read Pierce's book, I presumed that that is where he got the name, but he tells me that wasn't the case. Instead of fighting the bureaus as in the Oliver book, Earl Turner and his compatriots were taking on the system. And of course, instead of writing letters, Earl Turner keeps a diary. Pierce told me he wrote 26 chapters of the Turner Diaries, one for each issue of the Tabloid Attack, over a period of 3.5 years. He said that the one thing he made sure to do was get one piece of violence or heightened action into each episode in order to keep his readers interested. He said he knocked out the episodes quickly as deadlines were short and that he had no idea they would ever comprise a book. If he had known they were going to receive as much attention as they eventually did receive, he told me, he would have tried to do a better job with the writing. And Pierce told me exactly the same thing. A number of times, Pierce expressed to me that he didn't think the Turner Diaries is very well written. He seemed somewhat embarrassed about the book's literary merits. He thinks that Hunter, the novel he wrote in the mid-1980s, which has received much less attention than the Turner Diaries, is a far better written book. Yes, he told me precisely that. But the point is, whether he accepted it or not, is it didn't matter. There's a time for things. And the ideas in it mattered more than the literary quality. When Pierce completed the Turner Diaries installments in 1978, he thought he had something worth publishing as a separate volume. He sent the manuscript to 11 or 12 publishers, he told me, and they all turned it down. He then published the manuscript himself. It has been sold in what Pierce calls the underground market, through ads in survivalist magazines, at gun shows, by individuals selling the book to their friends, and through the catalog of his own National Vanguard Books. The book has been remarkably successful, with over 300,000 copies sold and perhaps a 500,000 readers. There was a departure from the underground sales pattern for a short period after all the attention the Oklahoma bombing brought to the book. A commercial publisher, Barricade Press, picked it up. Bob DeMars, had put together a promotional package and sent it to 29 publishers, and Barricade had, quote, bought in, unquote, says Pierce. Barricade is the operation of Lyle Stewart, who ironically is Jewish. Pierce told me that Barricade thrives on controversy and that the Turner Diaries is the sort of book it publishes. In the preference to the Barricade edition of the Turner Diaries, Stewart writes that he personally finds the book reprehensible, but that he believes as a matter of free speech it warrants being made available to the public. Soon after Barricade picked up the Turner Diaries, it went bankrupt and the rights to the book reverted to Pierce. One of the other of Barricade's books alleged that a Las Vegas figure, Steve Wynn, who is also a Jew, was a front for organized crime. Wynn sued the publishing house for libel and was awarded a $3 million judgment. That broke Barricade. So Pierce is back to selling his own book. What exactly did Pierce write in the Turner Diaries? What did Timothy McVeigh and its thousands of others who have been affected by the book read in its pages? That's next. So that ends Chapter 9 of The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, and we're up to page 142 out of about 400. So, my name again, Alex Linder, and my forum, VNN Forum, is where you can find everything that we record here as part of the Learning College. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.